Shadow of Truth is based on one of the most watched true crime docuseries on Netflix, which was produced by Sunnyside Up and Hot 8. The original interviews were translated from Hebrew and are voiced by actors. Each episode focuses on a different angle of the case and should not be seen as an independent piece. The listener is asked to take a note of the complex and contradictory aspects of the story in its entirety. This podcast contains strong language and violent scenes. Hi, thank you for tuning in to the sixth episode of the Shadow of Truth podcast. I'm your host, Omri Rose, and this time, as promised, we're going to talk to the creators of the original docuseries Shadow of Truth, Yotam Gendelman and Ari Pines. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Omri. Thank you for having us.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
At the end of this episode, we will also tell you what was the final decision in Zadalov's motion for retrial, which was given recently, so stay tuned. First off, let me ask you, how did you come to make this series?
So we started working on Shadow of Truth around 2014. Back then, both Yotam and I were students, and I was also working as a journalist. And one of the articles that I've made was about the Tahir Rada murder case. I remember that very day Yotam and I were sitting in a bar in Tel Aviv, and we started talking about it, and things kind of started rolling from there.
I remember while he was telling the story, I was just amazed at how big was this mystery, how weird it was, and the fact that you actually can't even have like a definitive answer, but then also a story that you have so many twists and turns in and so many weird and fantastic elements to it that we figure out very quickly that this might be a story we should tell.
Yeah, I would add that we were both true crime buffs, and back then there was no Israeli true crime series. Even more than that, there was no American true crime series. All of those series, like Making a Murderer and The Jinx, came out around the same time that Shadow of Truth did. We just figured out that this could be the perfect story to make the first Israeli true crime series. And I think the reason for it is the fact that, you know, you have this murder case and there's this guy sitting in jail for it, Roman Zadorov, and yet somehow most of the country was not convinced by the verdict that he was in fact the murderer. And this isn't something that happens a lot, you know. Usually there's a murder, the police arrest someone, he's convicted, and that's the end of the story. And this time the courts didn't seem to convince the public, and I think a big part of it is Ilana Rada. The fact that the victim's own mother did not believe the narrative of the police and prosecution, did not believe that Zadorov killed her daughter, this kind of started this whole national movement.
What was the first step that you took?
I think the first thing we did was actually call Tahir's mother, and we told her, hey, we are these two young guys from Tel Aviv. We really want to tell your story, but we need your blessing because, you know, we won't do it if you won't give us your blessing. And we just scheduled a trip to Katsrin. And I think it took us like a day or two and we were there.
You're listening ad-free on Wondery Plus.
And so we went to visit Ilana and Shmuel in Katsrin. And we told them that our plan is basically to do a series about this story. And the first thing that we told them is that we don't come with an agenda. We don't know what happened. And we're not going to decide. We're just going to look into this case from every possible angle. We didn't want to promise them like, hey, we're going to find out what's the truth. We're going to bring you, you know, the murderer. We didn't want to make these promises because we knew that's impossible. Like, there is no certainty in this case. There is no certainty in a case that has no, you know, DNA evidence that can point at someone.
What was amazing, by the way, when we came to visit Ilana and Shmuel, everybody thought it's going to be like maybe an hour meeting. But that hour turned to be something like 7 or 8 hours till we left. We talked for hours and hours. We argued, we yelled, we hugged, we did everything back then. It was really like a very tense and emotional meeting. You know, after 8 hours, we actually left the place knowing that we love them and that we count on them, and we know that they're actually counting on us.
What more can you tell us about Ilana and Shmuel?
I think the first thing we noticed about Ilana and Shmuel is how different their views were as to what happened to their daughter. Shmuel was an ex-military guy. He believed in the system. And I guess that's the reason why he was convinced that the police had the right guy, and he never doubted it. And Ilana was the exact opposite. You know, something just told her that this wasn't the right guy. And so it was pretty remarkable to see how this murder case, not only did it split the country between people who believed that Zadorov did it and people who were sure that he's innocent, it also split the victim's family. Usually parents long for an explanation. They need something to explain why this happened to them. And so usually when the police comes up with this explanation, when they arrest someone, they automatically believe it. And Ilana, she just listened to her inner voice that told her that something here is wrong. And she had the courage and the power to go against the police and prosecution. And so we stayed in touch with Ilana to this very day. You know, we talk to her on a weekly basis. We're very close with her. And I think both, you know, for both of us, I can say that she's probably the bravest woman that we've ever met.
We think we owe so much to her. And I think even as a society in Israel, she became such a big, you know, figure and character that as a society, we owe a lot to her of learning how to doubt the system, how to ask questions, and how to always look for answers and never give up.
Why did you choose this story? I mean, what was the idea you were trying to convey?
I think as we started looking into this story, what struck us is the fact that there were so many stories revolving this murder, so many different rumors and narratives and theories. And it's amazing how, you know, if you would go to any person in Israel, whether it be a taxi driver or someone who worked at the local supermarket, every person in Israel has an opinion as to who murdered Tahir Rada. And everyone thinks that his opinion is the only one that counts. He's sure he knows what happened there, and everyone else is wrong. This was something that we found very interesting, because you have a case with evidence, and people look at this evidence and they create very different theories from it. And this was kind of the thing that drew us into this story. And the idea that we were trying to convey is that in a case like this, where you don't have this definite proof, all you are left with is stories. You know, it can be testimonies, it can be a confession. These are all stories that you can believe or not believe. You don't have a definite way to know if such a story is real or not. And I think this is the basic idea that we try to convey in the series. Every story has two sides, and it's very hard to know a true story from a false one. And yet, we have a justice system. You know, we have judges who have to decide on such cases. You know, they hear the story that the prosecution tells them, they hear the story that the defense tells them, and at the end of the day, they need to decide which story is true and which isn't. And when they don't have scientific evidence to help them make this, basically they need to rely on intuition. And intuition can always lead to mistakes. This is the reason why we have this thing called reasonable doubt. If all you have is stories, you always have doubts.
Talk me through your research process. How long did it take?
As we mentioned back then, I mean, it started all in a very straightforward way. We went to your parents, and a week later, we already had like hundreds, if not thousands, of pages and documents, and we started reading. And it took us, I think, a few weeks or months to read everything about this case. Usually research, even if it's interesting, it's half boring, because you have to go through so many details and loose ends and legal documents that tells you nothing. But this story is actually so interesting that I think both of us were just obsessed about it. And it took us maybe 2 or 3 months to figure out basically what we wanted to tell about this story.
So I would say that the research process took about 3 years. We, you know, the research was going on until the very last moment. We were still finding out new stuff all the time. We still do find out sometimes, you know, new stuff about this case. There's so much material. And then we had to talk with all of our interviewees, which means, you know, we went to the lawyers, to the prosecutors, to the cops, to everyone. And basically, we told everyone the same thing. We don't have an agenda. We want to help you tell your story in the best possible way. And so in this way, we just convinced everyone to be on board with us, and we were ready to go.
Every time after you finish a meeting, you have to keep doubting yourself. Because usually if you sit with the prosecutor for like 12 hours, you're going to be convinced. And then you go to the defense and you figure out, oh shit, I mean, he didn't do it. It's a never-ending spiral where you, each time you believe those great storytellers and what they tell you.
Let's talk about Roman. What did you think about his story?
So when we talk about Roman's story, I think first of all, you have to talk about the most major piece of evidence that he was convicted for, which is basically his confession. Now, when you watch his confession, when you see how he describes the way that he murdered this young girl, you say to yourself, no one would say these things unless he really committed the crime. And I think this is why a lot of people are convicted based on confessions. But then we kind of looked into the Innocence Project and we read about other cases that were also based on confessions, and you realize that people often give false confessions. It happens much more than we would like to think. And then the question that rises is, how can you tell between a true confession and a false one? And this is very hard. It's virtually impossible. The only way is maybe to look at the facts that the suspect knew about the crime. And in Roman's trial, the prosecution said that he knew a lot of information about the murder. But when we kind of dug into the interrogation tapes, we saw that a lot of the information that Roman knew was actually told to him by the detectives during the conversations. And then you also see that the most important pieces of information that he should have known about this crime, he got them wrong. For instance, you would expect that the real murderer would know which kind of knife was used to perform the murder. And also Roman couldn't lead the detectives to the murder weapons. So this is an example for something that made us doubt this confession. But I think the thing that gave us the biggest doubt is the fact that while there was no forensic evidence that tied Roman to the murder scene, there was evidence that seemed to point at someone else. And I'm talking about the 3 bloody footprints that were found in the murder scene in the lock stall where Tahir was found. Everyone agreed that these footprints illustrate an escape route out of the stall. And everyone agrees, including the prosecution, that they didn't belong to Zadorov. We think that the fact that these shoe prints most likely belonged to the murderer that escaped from the scene should have been enough to exonerate Roman. And I think this is what cast the biggest doubt on his guilt as far as I'm concerned.
First of all, I must say there is no clear-cut evidence that points to his innocence. Thing is, you don't have to prove someone's innocence, but you do have to prove his guilt. But what made me even more skeptical is that Roman was convicted, I mean, for the confession, but in his conviction, the judges talked a lot about other stuff that they found. They said they found like pedophilic material on his computer, that they found him reading an article about how to kill someone with a knife a day before he actually killed Tahir. And they gave a lot of weight on it, that he had a collection of knives. Lots of like weird details that paint a picture of, you know, a very bad person that can easily be the murderer. But then what's interesting about it, that years after his first conviction, all of these details, all of it crumbled down. By now we know he never looked and never read an article like this. The photos he had in his computer are not only not pedophilic, just like normal porn, but they weren't even his. Bit by bit, all of those stuff crumbled down. And basically the image of Roman, when you get to know him, was a very normal person. He was never violent until the murder. He wasn't violent since the murder. So how can like a person, a totally normal person with a family, would come to do such a violent act for like, I don't know, 5 minutes of his life and then just be back to normal?
With Black Friday coming up, there's no better time than now to start feeling safer with Simply Safe. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Shadow of Truth listeners early access to all their Black Friday deals with 50% off their award-winning home security system. Named the best home security system of 2021 by U.S. News & World Report, these are Simply Safe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. It's super easy to set up, customize, and design the security that you need for your home. And with no long-term contracts, it's an easy way to get a bit more peace of mind. And if you're anything like my cousin, once you start using Simply Safe, you won't want to stop. And you'll be adding all sorts of bells and whistles and nifty gadgets that'll make feeling safe feel fun. Take advantage of Simply Safe's early Black Friday deals and get 50% off your new home security system by visiting simplysafe.com/shadow. Again, that's simplysafe.com/shadow for 50% off your entire system. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. As we all live our lives in this sometimes crazy world, constantly learning and growing as we go along, therapy is another tool that we can use to help improve ourselves and gain insight into what makes us tick, snap, or anything in between. Remember, going to therapy doesn't mean something's wrong with you, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, quite the opposite. You're being proactive to better yourself, to improve. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Why invest in everything else and not your mind? Shadow of Truth listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/shadow. That's BETTERHELP.com/shadow. Do you think he was intentionally framed by the police and prosecution, knowing that he was innocent?
We didn't find any clear-cut proof that this was the case. We should say, like, in the motion for retrial that is currently being discussed and that we'll get to, Roman's new lawyer claims that this is what happened. He claims that Roman was framed knowingly by the police and prosecution. You know, while this is possible, we didn't find any proof that this is what happened. And it's very likely that the police just thought that they had the right guy in their hands and that, you know, now they just need to do what they need to do to get a confession from him. And in order to do that, they kind of, in my opinion, allowed themselves too much. I mean, the fact that Roman, during all of his very intense interrogation, was completely cut off from the outside world, that he didn't talk to a lawyer, that he didn't talk to his family, the fact that they lied to him about finding DNA evidence that connected him to this murder, all of this stuff could have resulted in the fact that he might have given a false confession. And I think the option that this was done not purposely is perhaps even more frightening than the other option, because who knows how often these things occur. You know, the fact is that Roman Zadorov's case became a very well-known case in Israel, but how many such cases are there that we never even hear about? And so I don't know if he was intentionally framed. It could be just a much more mundane reason that, you know, the prosecution and the police, like every person, have a confirmation bias. You know, they think they found the right murderer and now they just need to prove that in any way possible.
But the thing is, you can see, I mean, because of like overmotivation, they tend to like, you know, be blind to everything that might cast a doubt about the good work supposedly they've done. And it's a thing you see almost in every case. And it makes sense because people have to believe in what they do. I mean, if those people will doubt, I mean, the fact that Roman is the killer, you know, I think their guilt will be too tough to live your life knowing you put like the wrong person in jail. We just talked about how they painted the picture of like, you know, the crazy psychopath killer. A picture that helped them believe in their job, in their work, and in the fact that Roman is guilty.
If there were so many flaws in the investigation, how come he was convicted?
First of all, we would like to think that judges have the supernatural ability to know a false story from a real one, to know a false confession from a true confession. And the truth is that at the end of the day, judges are human beings, and like everyone else, they're prone to make mistakes. And also, we have to remember that when Roman's case got to the Supreme Court in 2015, one out of three judges actually vindicated Roman. He said he had too much doubt in his guilt. But the reality in Israel is that even if one judge says that this guy is not guilty, it's the majority that counts. And so Roman was basically convicted by the Supreme Court in a 2-against-1 situation. You know, we feel like the fact that one judge wanted to vindicate him should have been enough, but this is how the rule of law works in Israel, and so it wasn't enough.
Do you still think there's a possibility he's guilty?
You know, there always is. From day one, we knew that the only thing you can be certain about in this case is that you can't be certain of anything. You know, everything is possible. We don't have an evidence that proves that Roman did it. We don't have evidence that proves that Roman didn't do it. So with life, we tell you there's an objective way to know the truth in this case.
We're still waiting. Maybe like an evidence will pop up. You know, it will end the story. But it didn't happen for so many years by now, for 15 years. And I think we can probably be certain that it won't pop up anytime soon.
I think also, you know, our role as documentarists is not to decide if someone is guilty or not. You know, you do have a court for that. Our job is to raise questions, is to raise doubts. And I think this is what we try to do in Shadow of Truth. Now, what you do with these doubts, with all these question marks, that's up to the court. And we hope that the Supreme Court will reach the right decision when it comes to Roman's motion for retrial.
What about Tayil's friends, Nofar and Lee? Why did you decide to pursue that story?
Back then, actually, in 2014, when we started like looking into the story, I can actually remember like the first time we went to Katsrin and we met with Lee. Back then, she just like got out of the army and she worked at a gas station in Katsrin. And we went to meet her, and all the way it was kind of scary, and we got to the gas station and it was very dark, and then like Lee got out and we met her, and I think it took us like 30 minutes to realize she had nothing to do with the murder. Afterwards we met with Nofar, the other girl that was bullied by all the Facebook group as a killer, and she was also such a sweet girl. She had explanation for everything. You know, people like blamed her for being not traumatic enough after the incident, for not caring enough, for not crying enough. And we pretty quickly realized it was all bullshit.
I think it was important for us to tell this story to show people how easily you can create a conspiracy theory and to convince so many people and suck them into this theory, as it happened in this case. And most of it is not based on evidence. It's based on stuff that people write on Facebook, 99% of which is just wrong. And we just wanted to show how easily you can convince people of a conspiracy theory and how easily you can disprove it. And also to talk about the crazy online bullying that these girls went through, which is just heartbreaking. I mean, the fact that their friend was murdered was one tragedy, but the fact that they were blamed for murdering her and bullied on a day-to-day basis was just another traumatic event.
This story has, in a way, a good ending, because I think most people don't think they actually did it nowadays. And if we had a small part of making people realize they didn't do it, then we're pretty happy about it.
How did you find out about the story of Tom and Masha?
Actually, when we started working on the series, we didn't know anything about the Tom and Masha story. Tom went to the police in 2012. We started working on the series in 2014. And until that point, no one in Israel ever knew that this thing even happened. We were going over a document that was related to Roman's appeal. And in that document, his lawyers wrote in very few lines, they wrote the basic story of Tom and Masha. And when we saw the fact that there was a suspect that was arrested for this murder 6 years after Roman Zadorov was put into jail, and yet no one had ever heard about this story, and that there was a gag order on it, that kind of drew our attention. But we were very skeptical with this story at the beginning, and it took a lot of corroboration before we reached the point where we said, we have to let people know about this story. Not because we want to, you know, point the finger at Masha and tell everyone, you know, she's the real murderer and she's the guilty one. But because we felt like there was a whole story that was hidden from the Israeli public, and there were a lot of evidence that were never truly examined, because the police and prosecution who were supposed to investigate this case had all the reasons not to look into it.
And I think what actually drew our attention even more, that when we went to talk to Roman's defense, there was actually two public defendants. One of them actually became a judge shortly after. Super serious people. And they told us at the very beginning, we believe him, we believe Tom.
I remember we decided that we're going to call Tom to hear the story from him. There were a few months that we used to call him like every day, and he would just pick up and hang up the phone, because this was after his very intense interrogations and he was traumatized by them. I mean, he kind of didn't want to tell anybody about this story ever again. So it took a lot of convincing until he even agreed to meet with us. And I remember, you know, he was very paranoid. The first meeting, he only agreed to meet us in some gas station in the middle of nowhere at night. He was worried that we're recording him or I don't know what. It took a lot of time to kind of build some basic trust and to let him kind of just tell us the story. And after he did, you know, we heard this story, we said to ourselves, okay, that's a very weird story. And, you know, it might be a true story, it might be a false story. We don't really have a way of knowing. And so we did what we could to corroborate his testimony, which was, first of all, take him to a polygraph test, which he passed very successfully. Then, you know, we went over all of the investigative material to see what supported his testimony, what made us doubt his testimony. I think the major turning point in this case was when we talked to Mai Peleg, and when she told us the story about how Masha had confessed to a friend of hers which had committed suicide. When she told us the details of this confession, and they matched exactly the details that Tom told the police, we said, okay, if these two people that never met each other both said that they heard the same confession from the same person, then you can at least assume that they really heard this confession. You still can't know if the confession that they heard is real or not, but you can assume that they both heard it. And so this kind of gave us, you know, the confidence to say, okay, this is a story that we need to tell. This is a story that the public needs to know about.
Just as we tried to reach Tom, we did the same with Masha. We tried to talk to her a lot of times. We tried to convince her to give us an interview. Even if not an interview, we tried to convince her just to tell us her story. Unfortunately, she never wanted to do it. We met her with who was back then her boyfriend. We told her like what Tom claimed. She declined the interview, and she also declined it ever since.
Yeah, even after the series came out, we actually still wanted to do an interview with her to let her, you know, just present the facts from her point of view. And so we kept approaching her and asking her to give us an interview. We wanted to make maybe another episode to tell her side of the story, but she just said no, she didn't want to do a polygraph test. I mean, it's definitely her right not to want to give us an interview, so we can't argue with that. We felt like it was a shame because we were limited in how well we could present her side of the story, but we still did our best to do it. You know, when the police interrogated her, she claimed that Tom raped her, and it was important for us to talk about that and to show exactly what she blamed him for.
These days, it seems like no one has enough time to do anything, making speed the new currency. and a competitive advantage for companies across industries. And speed can all come from one thing, aligning everyone around what needs to be done. Now, not all work collaboration tools are created equal, some helping you organize your company's information, others allowing you to manage projects together, but Notion does both. It's your one-stop shop tool for your whole team to do it all, and it's beautifully designed, ensuring everyone will want to use it. For companies of all sizes, Notion provides one central and customizable workplace that can be tailored to fit any team and bring all teams together to get more done and move faster. Find out how Notion may be the missing piece your team needs to grow, get more done, and delight everyone who uses it in the process. Learn more and get started for free at Notion.so. You can check it out on your own and invite as many folks as you want to see how it works. Take the first step toward an organized, happy team today, again, at Notion.so. When did the series actually come out and how was it received?
When the series came out, it was received very well. You know, there was a period of time where our phones was just constantly ringing all the time. So it kind of became the talk of the day. A lot of the public became much more skeptical toward, the justice system, the police, the prosecution. They started asking questions, which we felt was a good thing. I can also tell about a response that we less liked, which is the fact that some people started bullying Masha. And this was something we were highly opposed to. And we talked about that in every possible chance that we had. And we're always against people trying to take the law into their own hands. I can say that the prosecution didn't like the series. You know, well, we interviewed the prosecutor. They were very supportive in the process of making the series, but I think they didn't really like the end result. They didn't like the fact that we raised so many doubts about Roman's guilt. I can even say that the state attorney held a special press conference where he said that Shadow of Truth is, and I quote, a serious threat to democracy. The state attorney got a lot of criticism for saying that, for actually, you know, attacking our freedom of speech. And so he later on retracted this quote and said he's sorry for it. So I would say it was basically received quite well.
We did promise our listeners to talk about the new DNA evidence that was found after the series came out. So what can you tell us about it?
The series came out after Roman was convicted by the Supreme Court, and by then he had a new lawyer called Yaron Halevi, who is the lawyer that started working on his motion for retrial, which he worked on for, I guess it'd be about 3 years. He did a very serious work and found a lot of interesting stuff. And about half of this motion deals with evidence that pointed Roman's innocence and at the fact that he was falsely convicted and maybe even framed by the police and prosecution. You know, a big part of this motion talks about all of the evidence that were destroyed while Roman's trial was still being held, including a lot of DNA evidence, which can never be tested because they were simply thrown to the trash. And the other part of Roman's motion for retrial centers on the possibility that Masha might have been connected to this murder. And his lawyer really delved into this story and based a lot of this motion about Tom and Masha's story, which is very rare. I mean, you rarely try to prove someone's innocence by blaming someone else. But this was his strategy, and as part of it, he really wanted to do DNA tests. The prosecution was really against doing these tests. He went to the court and demanded to do these tests, and at the end, like, they didn't really have anything to say. The prosecution, they just told him, okay, you know, we don't object to you doing these tests, but you're going to have to pay for them, and we don't think you will find anything. This was their official response. And so he went on and did this test, and there was a match. And the match was between a hair that was found on Tahir's body and the DNA that was taken from Tom, which was very surprising. Does that mean that maybe Tom was connected to this murder? This option didn't seem to make sense because Tom had a very solid alibi. He was at his work when the murder occurred. So there was no way that he could have committed this murder. You know, his phone was tracked. There is no doubt that he was away from Katrin when the murder occurred. So The other option is, and this takes me to Tom's first investigation by the police in 2012, where he said that Masha committed the murder while she was wearing his clothes, which might explain why that hair was found on Tahir's body. But then again, while very early on everyone thought, hey, this is DNA evidence and it's 100% true, this is not a clear-cut DNA evidence like we're used to. It's what's called a mitochondrial DNA match. What does that mean? It means that the hair that was found on Tahir's body can match Tom or anyone that shares his DNA from his mother's side. And so this definition is kind of vague. The Israeli Pathological Institute, who found this DNA match, they brought in an expert to say how common this type of mitochondrial DNA is in the Israeli population. And his estimate was that about 0.45% of the Israeli population has the same mitochondrial DNA. And so basically now there's a big dispute between the prosecution and Zadorov's lawyers. His lawyers say this is still a very strong piece of evidence that can connect Masha to the crime scene and to this murder. While the prosecution says this evidence is basically, it says nothing because thousands or even tens of thousands of people in Israel might have the same mitochondrial DNA as Tom has.
And now, the moment we've all been waiting for. Could you tell us what the judge recently decided in Zadorov's motion for a retrial?
So basically, it took a lot of time for the Supreme Court judge, Hanan Meltzer, to reach a decision in Zadorov's motion for retrial. And after almost 2 years, finally a decision was made in May 2021. And Meltzer announced that he decided to give Zadorov a retrial because the evidence that was presented to him was, in his opinion, enough so that it could change the result of the original trial. And it took us and I guess everyone else by surprise because there aren't a lot of retrials in Israel.
First of all, these are really, really good news. And they came, as Ari said, without any expectations. The chances were extremely low. Some will say it was like 99% for him not to get a retrial, but it did. And in a way, we're of course very glad because we always wanted him to get a retrial. We hope it will be, and we're sure it will be a fair trial, but we're waiting to see how it goes. A lot of people always told us since the show came out and became a national obsession that 5 judges out of 6, you know, convicted him over and over again. And courts usually are right. And there's no way, I mean, the decision will be overturned, but eventually it did. And we see where it goes.
So a few other things that have happened since that you should know about. Basically, after the decision was made to give Zadorov a retrial, the prosecution had 2 choices. They could either drop all charges against him, or they could pursue a retrial. And after thinking about it for several months, they decided that they want to pursue a retrial. And at the same time, they decided to finally close the file against Masha due to what they call lack of guilt after 9 years that she was considered a suspect in the case. Basically, it means, you know, as far as they're concerned, they have no doubt that Zadorov did it. Despite everything, and they are convinced that Masha is innocent. So the next step was that Zadorov's lawyer filed a motion to have Zadorov released to house arrest. The prosecution was, of course, against it, but eventually the judge decided that he should be released. So at the end of August, this decision finally came down, and Zadorov was released from jail and reunited with his wife and 2 kids. It was, at least for us, a very moving moment and got extensive coverage in all the major media sites here in Israel. And so now Roman is back with his family at home, getting ready for his new trial, which will start from the very beginning, as if the original trial never took place. Masha will be one of the many witnesses who will be summoned to testify. The new trial is set to begin this October 2021, And we will continue to follow the story up close and hope that people from all over the world will do the same.
Thanks for the interview, Yotam and Ali, and thanks to everyone who listened to this podcast. Now all that's left is to wait and see what the court will decide, and to hope that this case will get the ending it deserves. This was Shadow of Truth, and I'm Omri Rose, signing off from Tel Aviv, Israel. Shadow of Truth podcast was produced by Yotam Gendelman, Ari Pines, Mika Timol, and Ben Giladi, hosted by Omri Rose. Executive producers are Ori Globus, Kasha Niman, Max Alexander, Bama Naraji, and Roy Lev. Original music by Tom Doron and Asa Raviv. Opening theme song by Tony Niman. End song Imi Imi by Uva Ozeri. Edited by Honi Stolal. Additional editing by Roy Calvo. Additional research by Jenny Friedland. Mix by Jungle Sound House. This podcast was produced by Sunnyside Up, Rebel Way Entertainment, and Gramercy Hill, in association with CJENM America.